You're listening to Radio EcoShock on the People's Radio, Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Mother Earth is under the weather right now.
Mother Earth is under the weather right now. Hi there, welcome to Radio EcoShock. Today's program is loaded with new interviews you won't want to miss. Would you like to hear from the man who converted California Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to being a leading advocate for action on climate change? That's Terry Tamminen, and we have a fresh half-hour session with him recorded in Vancouver April 4th. Before that, Steve Shellhorn, Executive Director of Greenpeace Australia, joins us. We'll talk about Australia, the world's biggest exporter of global warming coal, and how Greenpeace aims to stop it. First, though, we go to Captain Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, just back from a hair-raising adventure, chasing Japanese whaling boats in the Southern Whale Sanctuary.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and we're honored to have Captain Paul Watson on board today. Paul, for those who spent the last few months living in a cave or watching sitcoms, can you tell us about the recent Sea Shepherd voyage to stop illegal whaling in the Southern Ocean?
Yeah, we just returned from the Antarctic coast of Antarctica, the Antarctic Whale Sanctuary, and we were able to locate and confront the Japanese whaling fleet and to shut down their operations. And shortly after that engagement, the Nishan Maru, the factory ship, suffered fire damage. Actually, the fire that raged for a week and pretty much destroyed their ability to continue whaling. So the ship had to retreat back to Japan, and had only got half of its quota. So it was a very good year for the whales down in Antarctica this year.
I wonder, how many did they take?
They took 508 whales out of a quota of just over 1,000.
And were some of those more endangered than others?
They were to take 10 fin whales, which are endangered, but I don't know how many they actually took. They didn't release that. At the end of this year, they want to go back and target 50 endangered humpbacks and 50 endangered fins. And we've told them that the humpbacks and the fins are our line in the sand. We're not going to allow that. It's a blatant violation of international conservation law. And so we're going to probably have to take a much more aggressive position with them at the end of this year.
So you think despite the fire and having to be towed out of there that they'll be going back next year in the same ship or a different ship? Or?
Well, they'll repair the damage. It'll be tens of millions of dollars, but the ship is owned by the Japanese government, so they have unlimited funding, really, to address this. It's a heavily subsidized industry. The Japanese don't really need the whale meat. It's now become sort of a matter of pride with them, and similar to the way the Canadian government is behaving on the seal hunt.
I've heard they've even used it for pet food. Is that true?
Yeah, they're trying to find all sorts of means of marketing the whale meat, and using it for dog and cat food is one of the most bizarre things to consider is that, you know, when people complain about whales, seals, and dolphins eating the fish in the oceans, that statistically the amount of fish that's consumed every year by domestic house cats is greater than the amount of fish consumed by the world's seals. So people just don't think about that when they're condemning seals and dolphins for eating fish.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I was recently at a lecture by Dr. Daniel Pauly. He's the head of the Fisheries Research Center at the University of British Columbia. And he said his team studied the question of whether marine mammals are to blame for the spectacular decline of food fisheries around the world. And not surprisingly, they found out that human overfishing and pollution are the real deal. And he said if they killed off every marine mammal in the world, the stocks of ocean life would still continue to plummet. It's a powerful speech. I don't know if you've heard it or if you've heard it from him.
No, but I've been saying that for years. I mean, just consider, what is the largest marine predator on the planet right now? Just give a guess. It's not the shark. Sharks are being wiped out. It's the cow. The domestic cow. We feed more fish to cows, pigs, sheep, and chicken than all the marine mammals in the world are consuming. The cow is the number one aquatic predator on this planet right now.
All right, you've shocked me with that one.
Because more than 50% of all of the seafood or fish, whatever, or fish meal taken from the ocean is processed into animal feed.
Getting back to the whaling in the Southern Ocean, New Zealand and Australia were instrumental, or at least supportive, of the Southern Whale Sanctuary back in the 1990s. Why can't they enforce it the way they fight off other illegal fisheries? Why call it a sanctuary at all? It seems like it's sort of hunting in a zoo, you know?
Well, they do enforce the waters down there. If you're a Uruguayan, they'll go after you. If you're an Indonesian, they'll go after you. They'll send patrol boats down to arrest Uruguayan Patagonia toothfish poachers in those very same waters the Japanese are operating in. The difference is Japan is an economic bully, gets what it wants. And so they're simply afraid to tackle the Japanese. The fact is, if it's a sanctuary, and not only that, most of the sanctuaries in the Antarctic Australian territory, it should be enforced. They haven't come up with any answers other than that. I think the one answer that was, well, Japan doesn't recognize our authority. Well, you know, Japan didn't recognize the sovereignty of Australia in 1942. It didn't stop Australia from fighting them.
Well, and we know Japan isn't the only country dirty with whale blood. The Norwegians started their season April 1st, and this time they raised their own limits by 30% to over 1,000 whales. And they're going to bring the hunt close to shore, where the whales can be killed right in front of the tourists there for whale watching. What do you make of that?
Well, also the Icelanders. I'm sending our ship, the Farley Mowat, from Australia to Iceland and Norway this summer. So we'll be heading out here in about 3 weeks. And so we'll be tackling them up there, too. I mean, the Norwegians are a little more honest than the Japanese. They're blatantly killing whales for commercial purposes. The Japanese are doing so, but they're trying to say it's so-called scientific whaling. But all three, Iceland, Norway, and Japan, are in blatant violation of international conservation law.
Canada's another outlaw. We talk about the eastern Arctic bowhead whales. There's only about 200 of them left, and yet the government continues to let the Inuit hunt them. And yet Canadians think they're mad at the Japanese for whaling.
Yeah, well, Canada withdrew from the International Whaling Commission, so any whaling activity by Canada is illegal. It's not. It's outside of the laws of the international authority. But, you know, Canada's record on marine mammal protection is horrendous. I mean, right now, over 250,000 seals have drowned because of global warming conditions with the ice, and they still set a quota of 275,000. That's over 500,000 seals will be killed this year. This isn't a conservation. This is simply a lunacy. What the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, Loyola Hearn, who's a Newfoundlander, is doing is acting as a Newfoundland Minister of Fisheries, basically appeasing the fishermen in Newfoundland. He's certainly not representing the rest of Canada.
Well, the ocean seems like a wild west with no sheriff, no law enforcement. What do you recommend to protect what is left?
Well, you hit it right on the head. It is the wild west. There is no law enforcement. There's plenty of laws. We got all the laws we need, but nobody's enforcing them. It's interesting that sea shepherds condemn, because we don't protest anything. We simply uphold international conservation law, and we're empowered to do so by virtue of the UN World Charter for Nature, which allows non-government organizations to do that. We're just following the book. But, you know, our opposition have a lot of money, these big factory trawlers and whalers and everything. It's incredible amounts of money, billions of dollars. So we're up against a very powerful enemy. And so the best way to deal with this is to constantly say, oh, you know, see, they're eco-terrorists or they're pirates. In fact, I don't really have a problem with the term pirate. We actually adopted our own pirate flag, our own Jolly Roger, because I recall that back in the 17th century, it wasn't the British Navy that shut down piracy in the Caribbean. They're all on the take, just like all the politicians are today. No, piracy was shut down by Henry Morgan, who was a pirate. So if you want to shut down pirates, you have to get pirates to do it. So we look on ourselves as pirates of compassion in search of pirates of profit.
Well, when we add this up, it paints humans as not just insane, but viciously crazy when it comes to other species on Earth. And you're out there on the front lines, year in and year out. How do you handle it personally? Are there days when it really gets to you?
I do what I do for whales and sharks and seals and that. I don't do what I do for people, you know, so that it really doesn't bother me what people think about what we do. You know, after we sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet a few years ago, I had a former colleague from Greenpeace came up, and he said, I just want to tell you that what you did in Iceland was inexcusable and unforgivable and criminal. And I said, hold it right there. I don't really care what you think, because we didn't sink those whaling ships for you or for Greenpeace or for anybody on this planet. We sank them from the whales. And if you can find me one whale that disagreed with what we did that day, I promise you we won't do it again.
I object, says the whale. Unlikely. Well, you started out life on Canada's east coast, and you spent a lot of years kicking around the world's oceans, but you've also lectured in universities, so that's an odd mix of sailor and a teacher and an activist. What's coming up for you now?
Well, this year we're focusing on our campaign to Iceland to protect whales, our campaign to Antarctica at the end of the year to go after the Japanese whaling fleet again. We have a full-time operation with our vessel Sirenian in the Galapagos, where we're working in partnership with the Galapagos National Park to stop poaching down there. We're also intervening against dolphin killing in Japan. We're protecting seals in South Africa and opposing the seal hunt in Canada. And we're also confiscating on a routine basis illegal long lines in both the Pacific and the Atlantic. So it certainly keeps us busy, and unfortunately we are only touching the tip of the iceberg of all of the problems.
Did you manage to get your ship relicensed when Canada yanked the flag from it?
Well, yeah, Canada pulled our flag, and the reason they gave for pulling the flag was, on the letter I received, the reason given, none. We found later it was from Japanese pressure. Now they've turned around and charged me. Now, this is interesting. When we were down in Antarctica last year, they changed the status of my ship from yacht to commercial vessel while I was at sea. Then when the ship docked in Cape Town, they charged me for not having the papers to command a commercial vessel. They're now wanting to fine me, if I plead guilty, $27,000 for that. Of course, I'm not going to plead guilty. But this is the kind of harassment that we can get on a continual basis.
Well, let's take a slightly different tack. What would you really like to tell us about? What should listeners know about?
Well, what they should really know about is that the oceans of the world are dying. They're dying right before our eyes, but for the most part, it's out of sight and out of mind. Nobody should be eating seafood at all, you know. And we certainly shouldn't be feeding it to our cows and pigs and everything, and all this farm-raised salmon, which is, you know, it takes 30 to 50 fish caught from the ocean to raise one of those guys. You know, we're just literally eating the oceans out of existence. And if we don't stop it, we're going to be in some serious trouble, because not only do the oceans provide, you know, protein for people who desperately need it, you know, in third world countries where that's all they've got, but it also provides 80% of our oxygen supply. And you start messing with that phytoplankton and the relationship between prey and predators and not knowing what we're doing, the way we're going about it, we're going to literally suffocate from what we're doing. And, of course, everybody's going to say, oh, my God, this guy's a doom and gloom Cassandra. I get called that a lot. But, you know, I like to remind people that when they call me that, that they should remember that Cassandra was a doom and gloom prophet, but she was right.
Well, you're right in there with a lot of scientists who are also calling out for action on this. And for those of us who are still sitting in our cars and condos, but we do care, how can we help?
Well, I think the most important thing is that people should refrain from eating seafood. And if I, who was raised in an East Coast fishing village on a diet of seafood, can do it, anybody can do it. And second of all, you know, get involved with the groups that are actually out there doing things. I don't support the big organizations, but the small grassroots community organizations that are trying to protect this planet, those are the ones that should be supported.
We've been speaking with Captain Paul Watson, the founder and organizer of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Find them at www.seashepherd.org. Paul, thanks so much for talking with Radio EcoShock today.
Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
I'm speaking with Steve Shellhorn, the Executive Director of Greenpeace Australia, and what's on our mind today is coal, because that's what keeps me up late at night lately. We've heard there's a whole bunch of new coal plants being built all around the world, and it's appropriate we talk with Steve, because Australia is, I believe, the world's biggest exporter of coal. Is that true, Steve?
Yes, it is. Australia is the largest exporter of coal, and they're not content with just sitting still. There are plans to build more coal mines and more infrastructure, such as rail lines and port facilities, so that they can extract ever more of this black death from the planet, and particularly from the continent of Australia.
Can you give us a bit of a picture of the industry there? I mean, is there a particular area where it's mined?
It is mined in different parts of the country, but a lot of it is in New South Wales, where coal is quite close to the surface. So most of the coal mining in Australia is of the open pit variety, so relatively high capitalization and not many jobs.
And you say they're going to build new railways and new ports. What about the idea of global warming? Isn't that hitting Australian consciousness there?
Well, it is hitting popular consciousness, but not governmental. Both the federal government and the New South Wales government are firmly committed to the coal industry. There was just an election in New South Wales towards the end of March, with somewhat ironically the Labor government there running for re-election with using climate change as an issue. But it very steadfastly refused to discuss coal as part of its campaign platform. And in fact, it was delaying permits of at least one coal mine at Anvil Hill till after the election, knowing that if it approved it before the election, that it would be a very unpopular move.
And does Australia depend for coal for its own electricity generation?
A very high amount of Australian electricity comes from coal. It's up around 88%.
And yet, the reason I ask all the details here is it seems to me that Australia is one of the first big victims of climate change when we look at, what, you've got a 100-year drought and fires going on there?
Yes, Australia is one of the top three places that is expected under IPCC models to be affected by drought. And drought has been happening throughout the last 10 years or so. About 98% of the state of New South Wales is considered to be in drought. But somehow there's a policy disconnect between the use of coal and especially the export of coal and climate change.
Right. If we ship it over and it gets burned somewhere else, it's not our problem. Is that the thinking?
That's very much the thinking. And, of course, a mainstay of the Australian economy is mineral exports. So coal is a big part of that, but also other minerals and, of course, uranium. And so the kind of economic boogeyman of economic recession is brought forward by government and, of course, coal industry itself. Every time, the inherent logic of coal exports leading to climate change is brought up in public debate.
So even if we burn down our own continent, we got to make a buck here and keep the jobs going.
Exactly. That is the thinking in many policymakers' minds. Now, it is starting to change. I mean, there is a debate down here in Australia, which is good. Tim Flannery, who is known in Canada, was honored as being the Australian of the Year for this year. He's a voice of reason, as there are many others. Greenpeace certainly is one organization that's campaigning very strongly against the coal industry and in particular against coal exports. In the example of the Anvil Hill mine, which is only about 2 hours away from Sydney, it's in the Hunter Valley, which is already the scene of a lot of coal mining, and a lot of that coal is black coal and is sent to Newcastle for export. The city of Newcastle is the largest coal exporter in the world. They have five very large shipping terminals, so they can load five bulk carriers simultaneously. They want to increase both port facilities to do seven simultaneously. But in that Hunter Valley, there's also a very large winemaking industry and horse-raising industry, horse-stud industry. And those industries are starting to become very vocal in their opposition to coal mining because coal dust doesn't do anything for grapes or for racehorses.
What sort of actions has Greenpeace Australia been involved in when it comes to coal?
Mostly what we've been doing is a lot of community organizing in the Hunter Valley to get opposition raised, as I mentioned, from these other key industries, the winemaking industry, the horse stud industry, and also the tourist industry. Because mostly when you have mining, they're all in areas where there's no other economic alternatives. And in this case, there are plenty of economic alternatives, and that tends to dull the arguments that the coal mining is necessary for community development, because in the Hunter Valley, clearly it is not. So we've been working with community groups as well as doing some of Greenpeace's signature actions in Newcastle Harbour. Earlier this year, Greenpeace activists shut down a coal conveyor that was being used to load one of the bulk carriers. So those are the range of activities that Greenpeace is doing, as well as going after the regulatory process, trying to push to make sure that emissions of coal, not only domestic issue emissions, but emissions from exports, are taken into consideration when a permit for a new coal mine is being considered.
Well, other Greenpeace organizations have been active on this, too. I've seen protests on a new coal plant opening in Germany and also another one in the Philippines. Have you been involved with that, or are they getting in touch with you and saying, all right, how can we work with Australia, since it does seem to be a main target as the biggest exporter?
Yes, we are working internationally with other Greenpeace offices, the ones you mentioned, and also the office in New Zealand has been very successful in closing down Marsden 2, which is a new coal facility that was being planned in New Zealand. So we are working together to develop tactics and strategies to harness this industry and to stop its expansion and eventually its phase out. Of course, one of the obstacles that we face is this notion of clean coal, the idea that coal, which is essentially 90% carbon, can somehow be made clean. Mostly what people are talking about is sequestration or carbon storage, the idea that you would somehow be able to capture the emissions from a smokestack of a coal plant and store it underground.
Well, everybody's talking about it, but nobody's doing it. I've looked into this, and there are a couple of temporary test plants and so on, but all the new coal plants that are being built, there's no sequestration plans for them.
Absolutely. I think coal sequestration is a fantasy. Even the World Coal Association, which is the booster association for the coal industry, says that by 2020, it hopes to only have 9 facilities operating globally. So, as you mentioned, it's not being done anywhere, and even if you believe the World Coal Association, it's well over a decade before it will be this idea will be operating even on a test scale. And when you look at kind of individual places, there's no place that sort of stick their hand up and say, "Okay, ours is going to be ready by 20 fill in the blank." So really, it's just a fantasy, and it's very. There's many problems with it, not least of which is that most coal facilities that are now being operated would not, you couldn't use coal sequestration or carbon sequestration with. You'd have to build a new plant, and the expense would be considerable. One of the so-called economic advantages of coal is that it's relatively cheap, and that is if you don't take into account externalities. But if you start adding, trying to store carbon onto the cost of generating electricity, it skyrockets.
Where does Australian exported coal go to? Who's burning it?
The major receiver of Australian coal is Japan, about 40-45% kind of depending on the year. Other big customers are South Korea, China, and India. But Australian coal finds its way all over the place. It goes to many European countries as well as to the U.S.
You know, I can walk a few blocks from my place and look down over a railway overpass, and there's endless coal trains going out to be shipped from British Columbia, and it's going to Japan towards the steel industry. So Canada's part of the problem, too.
Yes, Canadian coal mines are very much a part of the problem as well.
And just thinking out loud here, you know, part of the problem is that if a lot of big plants are going to go up in China and India, and the governments don't seem to be able to act, maybe there's some way that we as individuals can get in touch with each other over the net to make friends in China or India. We've got to do something to reach across the world to stop this madness, because from what I can see, next to nuclear weapons, this is the biggest single threat to the future course of humanity and all the species.
Yeah, coal is a very serious threat, and it is something that can be worked on by people in other countries. Greenpeace has energy campaigns in China. We're working to promote renewables with some success, but unfortunately the scale of power needs in China is seen to be so large that there's continued reliance on coal.
That was Steve Schallhorn, Executive Director of Greenpeace Australia. Find out more at www.greenpeace.org/Australia. In his hard-hitting new book, Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction,
Terry Tamminen explains how millions are dying too young due to vehicle exhausts and other oil products in our environment. Not only that, the health costs, plus military adventurism to protect foreign oil, costs the public hundreds of billions of dollars every year. He says the real cost of gasoline is over $10 a gallon. Terry Tamminen was the energy and climate change advisor to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, and now campaigns to get real oil reduction policies in states and provinces in North America. In this half-hour segment, we'll hear Terry answer questions from the audience at his book launch in Vancouver, Canada, on April 4, 2007. At the end, I'll tell you how you can download the original one-hour speech.
Thank you very much, Terry. That was terrific. And I think it was just the teaser now for the discussion that we're going to have with everybody here. So we'd like to open up the floor to questions, and we have two mics, one on either side.
Of course, I'm going to ask your advising Premier Campbell question. The issue that came to mind as you were talking for me was the Gateway Project that you might be familiar with. So there's the proposed twinning of the port. Well, not proposed. The Liberal government, the Campbell government, is advocating the twinning of the Portman Bridge. We have a huge pollution problem because of automobile exhaust in the Lower Mainland and the Fraser Valley where it's worse. Mm-hmm. And essentially the Gateway Project will just open up the Lower Mainland and the Fraser Valley to more traffic to and from Vancouver. And so I want to know, are you advising the Campbell government to consider greener alternatives to the twinning of the Portman Bridge?
Well, look, first of all, let me make it clear, when I say I'm advising the Campbell government, it's you know, in broad terms, it's connecting them to other leaders like Governor Schwarzenegger and other technologies and partners, scientific partners and academic partners around the world who can help think these things through. Far be it from me to come up here, a carpetbagger from California, and say, look, this particular policy or this particular project is good or bad. But that said, you know, I think when you start measuring things in terms of greenhouse gas reductions, if you look at a project like that, and I've heard a little bit about it, so again, I don't know that much about it, but if you look at some of these things and you say, well, we're going to allow an exponential increase in greenhouse gases and other emissions over here, but we still want to achieve our goals of overall reductions, wow, that means over here in these industrial sectors, I guess we're going to have two or three times greater reductions because we're letting these guys off the hook. Well, suddenly, these guys over here say, wait a minute, that's not right. Let's figure out how to get everyone to contribute equally. And land use planning is a huge component of that, as we can certainly tell you from California, where we've spent decades doing it wrong. I would argue we not only invented smog, we invented sprawl. And certainly some of that, as I said, is because of the manipulations of oil and auto companies over the years. But we were willing participants in that and still, unfortunately, are. So I think, you know, far be it from me to preach to another government about how to get that sort of thing right, but I think you ask the right questions, and you, as a citizen and presumably a voter here in this territory, in this jurisdiction, have the opportunity to ask those questions and offer alternative solutions and alternative visions, and I think you're right to do it.
I wanted to ask you, we've recently learned from New Science that some of the heavy rainfall we've experienced here is coalescing around particles that are coming from China and from Asia. Mm-hmm. How are we going to take some of the zeal that we have here to change, and hopefully we'll translate that into action, and communicate with the other people in other parts of the world that also need to grow with us into a more sustainable life?
Absolutely. You know, it's a very good point, and expressed another way. Some of you may have been following some of the climate change news in the United States recently, especially this past Monday, where the Supreme Court ruled that carbon dioxide is indeed a pollutant under our Clean Air Act, and whereas the Bush administration had been saying they don't need to regulate it, the courts, in a somewhat surprising 5-4 decision, given the way that the Bush administration has stacked the court, the court said, no, you do have to regulate it. It is a pollutant under the Act because the Act says anything that's known to cause harm to the population or to the environment, and clearly CO2 does that. So in looking at that, you know, we've had reactions from the White House, from a lot of conservative members of our Congress in the United States, and commentators say, well, all right, maybe it's a problem, maybe it should be regulated, but why should we bother? Because China's going to overwhelm any reductions we could make. They're just going to overwhelm it with what they're doing. Well, let me ask you something. Why do you think China is building 1,000 megawatts a week of coal-fired power plants? It's to power the factories that are making plastic flamingos and tennis shoes to ship to Walmarts to sell to us. And so when I talk to people about the fact that the United States is responsible, we're home to 5% of the world's population, but we emit 25% of the world's greenhouse gases, I actually think it's twice that. Because when you factor in why China and India are growing so exponentially, it's on our behalf. We're also exporting our lifestyle to them. 10 years ago, the most popular car sold in China was a two-door, 45-mile-per-gallon sedan. Today, it's a four-door, 27-mile-per-gallon SUV. And I saw a presentation by a Chinese professor recently about the first documented cases of urban sprawl in China with their growing middle class. Now, I'm all for seeing China, India, the rest of the emerging economic world see economic prosperity, because I think it's the greatest way to have world peace. Everybody has a stake in the outcome. Everybody wants to make sure the economic engines keep going. That's terrific. But we don't need to be exporting our culture, our car culture, our sprawl culture through the popular media and through our car companies. Once again, over there, General Motors pushing SUVs that they're now having a tough time selling in America. So that's a long answer to your short question, but I wanted to lay that groundwork first, because to me, the only way we're going to solve this problem there is to be more informed consumers ourselves. And I think there is a consumer movement that's about to begin, much like those of us who are old enough to remember the movement around divestiture of companies that were doing business in South Africa, that led to the downfall of apartheid. Many of us can remember the efforts around sweatshops when it was revealed that Nike and some of these other very popular clothing makers and so forth were making T-shirts that they were selling for $50, and they were having child labor in India and Bangladesh making these things for 5 cents apiece. Suddenly that led to a change. I think the same thing is likely to happen here soon, where companies are going to have to disclose the greenhouse gas emissions that are used in the making of their products. And they're going to start marketing that, hey, my T-shirt only took, you know, a pound of greenhouse gases to make, and the one that guy's selling probably took 500 pounds. Buy my T-shirt. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is this. When Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of England, came to visit us last August in California, he said, look, what you are doing in California is absolutely crucial to getting India and China and the other emerging economies to do their fair share as well. Because, he said, when I meet with the leaders of those countries, they say to me, why should we bother putting any kind of emissions controls on our factories or dealing with this, maybe taking economic risk, if the United States doesn't? They invented the problem. And he said, I say to them, but the United States is solving the problem. It's just not at the federal level. Look at what California is doing. Look at what the northeastern states are doing with their regional greenhouse gas initiative and so forth. And he said, but I can't just point to those few examples. I've got to have more, which is one of the reasons that Governor Schwarzenegger and I are going out and talking to other states and trying to cobble together a United States response, but from the states, because it won't happen at the federal level anytime soon. So the same thing I think is true here in Canada, is that by setting a good example in your provinces, especially while you're waiting for your federal government to take more comprehensive action, we can tell a story to China and India and these emerging countries before the next round of Kyoto, and they will respond. And you'll have advocates like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Tony Blair, and hopefully people like Premier Campbell, who will be out there explaining to them, yes, we're doing our part, and now we need you to do yours.
So obviously, you talk about the 1 to 1,000 return on lobby dollars, and obviously that's pretty compelling to those investors. At what point do we as voters and as consumers have to start making the effort really about subsidizing these massive infrastructure projects for clean energy? I mean, isn't it if we made it, you know, economically attractive by both being I mean, you talk about the Priuses and the fact that likely there's this room is, you know, it's the green movement from a consumer perspective is hot and likely will continue to be. So both from a consumer side as well as a voting side of saying, look, we're going to give favor with our vote with our pocketbooks, isn't the economic subsidy the most important, or if not the most, one of the most important things that we need to start doing is saying, hey, we support these subsidies, whether it be from big oil or from some upstart. We need to start, if you know, giving an economic rationale to make this infrastructure work.
Well, absolutely, and that's the reason in my book that I talk about this true cost of the oil addiction, because I want people to be armed with facts when they're debating this or trying to influence policy outcomes at the state or federal level, at least in the United States, to understand that the only reason that our current way of doing business appears to be relatively cheap, whether it's, you know, 6 cents a kilowatt electricity or whether it's $2.50 a gallon gasoline, that's not the real price. And that as long as we continue to subsidize those things, then we should subsidize the other industries, the cleaner industries, at least to a similar level, and level the playing field. Better yet, we would roll back the subsidies altogether. By the way, I should just tell you a quick side note. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I announced on an online environmental magazine called Grist that I am running for president of the United States. And in that announcement, I said that, you know, we have a bumper crop this year of presidential candidates, and most of them must know they're not going to win. So why do they do it? They do it because they want to elevate some issue to the national debate with their candidacy. So on that basis, knowing I probably won't win and that I want to elevate this to the national level, I hereby declare my candidacy. And my platform is very simple. It's number one, leave Iraq tomorrow. Save $100 billion to the American taxpayers. Number two, roll back the... Number two, roll back the $100 billion in subsidies to the oil industry. They don't need it anymore. Now you have $200 billion. What do you do with that? First thing is you spend $70 billion to pay for the 45 million Americans who have no health insurance. And it doesn't matter if they're legal or illegal immigrants. It doesn't matter if they're young or old, rich or poor. You simply insure them. Because right now we're actually giving them insurance in the United States. I know this is a little bit off topic, but it's directly related because it's why we don't have money to spend on other things like clean energy. We're spending the money in providing health care to these people reactively instead of proactively in doctor's offices, and we're giving it to them in emergency rooms instead of in their doctor's offices. So spend $70 billion, cover the 45 million Americans with health insurance that have none. Spend another $70 billion every single year until it's done, converting all of the diesel engines in America, and you know what, we could help Canada too, converting them to clean alternative energy. Now there's one way to immediately start subsidizing that industry, at least to the same level as the oil industry. Start converting all the diesel trains, trucks, buses, especially school buses where we're putting our kids at risk. Convert all of those from diesel to clean alternative energy, whether it's electric or whether it's hydrogen, but completely clean vehicles. Use that money for a massive campaign to convert all of these mostly public vehicles and fleet vehicles to cleaner alternatives, which will then incentivize and mass produce these things for consumer vehicles. And then the last part is to spend the other $70 billion to offer a 4-day work week to every government employee who agrees to donate 1 day a week to community service in their own community. Because we're not going to solve our problems, and I suspect the same is probably true here in Canada, we're not going to solve most of our problems just by money alone. And if we get people, think of all the person hours that you would have if people were investing in their communities a day a week. You'd also take a lot of people off the freeways, you'd reduce traffic, and we'd have a much better quality of life. And then obviously if the government did that, you could encourage private companies to do likewise. And we would completely change the culture, I think, at least in the United States. So that's my platform, and as you can see, all of those things are tied together. We can't afford health care because we're subsidizing the oil industry. We can't afford to have quality education because we're killing people in Iraq to save a gallon of gasoline. Yes, sir.
2 years ago, or even 18 months ago, the environment, GHG, really wasn't on the political map. It didn't come up in our last federal election. The politicians weren't there. All of a sudden, they've changed because they've seen the people are leading them. That's not surprising. The politicians always
quite
follow.
Right. Yeah, there's one behind you now. I knew Gregor could take a joke.
But it's good now that, all right, it's good that we're seeing some action. Having said that...
By the way, where's your wallet?
I have no idea. It's probably at the back of the line. There was a newspaper article that came out last week in the London Independent saying that a survey of the British population showed that 70% of people, when they were asked whether they would change their lifestyles to reduce their CO2 consumption or production, 70% said no, they wouldn't do that. So how do you get the people who have the enthusiasm to move to a greener world but just don't want to pay for it?
You know, I think a couple of things. First of all, we can do this without a lot of sacrifice, and I know that sounds a little bit simplistic because there's going to be some sacrifice, but let me give you the good news first. In California in the 1970s, we faced the Arab oil embargo and an electricity crisis. And so we went to work mandating more energy-efficient cars, appliances, homes, whole host of things, changed the regulation around electricity and all kinds of things. The net result is that over the last 30 years, the average electricity consumption of Americans has gone up 50%, and in California, it's remained flat, totally flat. That's a huge difference, all because of appliance efficiency standards and other efficiency standards, which nobody notices. They walk into a Sears and they see 10 refrigerators, and they get to pick among 10 refrigerators, all of which are electricity and energy efficient. But 20 years ago, they would have looked at those same 10 refrigerators, and those would have been energy hogs. The consumer never knew what hit them, but their lifestyle changed because we had enlightened public policy and we put it into practice over time. Wasn't overnight, because we needed to give businesses time to catch up. We needed to make sure that it would work. But today we're better off as a result. We reduced greenhouse gases without even knowing that those were a problem 30 years ago. So some of this can be done, whether it's corporate average fuel economy standards with cars, whether it's changing to alternative fuels, whether it's providing more mass transit where it doesn't exist to make it easier for people and more desirable for people who don't really want to sit on a crowded freeway or sit in a box full of greenhouse gases and particulate matter. And we can, in England, for example, as you know, one of the quickest ways to reduce greenhouse gases is to insulate the very poorly insulated homes. And the Blair government has got a program to put money into helping people more quickly insulate their homes. Well, the Million Solar Roof Plan in California, we're giving subsidies to people to put solar on their roof, and after a couple of years, it pays it back and they get free electricity. Not everyone's going to do it, but a lot of people will. It's not a big sacrifice. So I think the first thing is to get the low-hanging fruit and to help people do the things that actually don't require a great deal of sacrifice. But then at the same time is to educate them about why they should care enough to make some other sacrifices. As I said before, who will be the first to say that I can do with a little less, that my children can have a little more? And I think as we get more and more of these stories out about what it's actually costing all of us, to deal with global warming, to subsidize the fossil fuel industries, people will be willing to make changes over time. You know, you said 70% said they wouldn't. That means 30% said they would. That's a good start.
Thanks very much for joining us tonight. I'm going to throw a bit of a kitchen sink at you because I am looking for a broad answer on some of the challenges that we're facing in public policy debate right now. So Canada has joined the renewable fuels world in the last 6 months. Between our federal and provincial governments, we've got a number of measures that are going to bring ethanol and biodiesel and the next generation cellulosic and renewable diesel technologies hopefully into our domestic production and fuel use in this country. So in the midst of bringing these policy tools to the table, we get a lot of focus and attention from the media. And there are probably four primary categories that we're debating the core issues on. Greenhouse gases would be one of them. Criteria air contaminant reduction would be another. Energy balance would be a third. And then, of course, the pervasive food versus fuel arguments. And I wonder if you could just share some of your thoughts across those four aspects for both ethanol and biodiesel.
Well, look, I think anything that displaces petroleum is a good step in the right direction for all the reasons I articulate in the book. And by the way, why don't we just do questions for those who are already standing, and then we'll break. I want to sign books for anyone who wants them. I want to be respectful of everyone's time, and I'm happy to stay longer and answer questions one-on-one, but just to be respectful. So I do think that anything that moves us a step away from petroleum is the right thing, because even though right now, and it's sort of embedded in your question, is the point that if you take a bushel of corn and you put it on a train and you send it to California to a refinery and make ethanol out of it, you don't get a whole lot of benefits in terms of the total amount of pollution, greenhouse gases, or energy consumption and so forth. But so far, we haven't invaded Kansas and killed anyone over a bushel of corn. So I think there are certainly some benefits. And if you spill that bushel of corn on the way somewhere, say in Colorado, you can sweep it up. Whereas the same is certainly not true when the Exxon Valdez runs aground again. And by the way, it could. It's been rebuilt and renamed the Sea River Mediterranean. So there's no question that we have to ask ourselves those questions. But I think most progress doesn't just happen in huge leaps. It does happen in increments. So I think biofuels, starting with ethanol and biodiesel, that are perhaps not the greatest for the reasons we just talked about, at least builds a market for those things, sends the signal to the manufacturers to make engines that run on it, and then builds that market so that then scientists are going to go out and say, well, wait a minute, maybe we could do this cheaper, better, faster. What about cellulosic? What about turning other materials into ethanol or biofuels that actually are more sustainable from all of those perspectives? So I think it's a step in the right direction, and it's something that we're going to need this entire basket of solutions to get to the promised land of 100% displacement of petroleum.
It's great to have you here in BC, Terry. It's an immense relief that the Premier's office is listening to you for all of us. So thank you for playing that role. Because he doesn't listen to the rest of us very often. The three Western governors signed an agreement, I believe, last fall to articulating their opposition to offshore oil and gas exploration, drilling, development. And in a rather stark contrast, shortly before the throne speech and shortly thereafter, Premier Campbell restated his commitment to pursue oil and gas development here off the BC coast. I'd love to hear your opinion. Both, is this consistent with setting aggressive greenhouse gas reduction targets, emissions targets, to be exploring and pursuing the development of offshore oil and gas? And does it, in fact, jeopardize our relationship and partnership with the Western states to move forward?
Well, look, I'm certainly not going to apologize for anything to do with oil and gas, as you can tell from the tenor of my remarks in the book. And Governor Schwarzenegger campaigned on the fact that he would protect our coast from any further offshore oil drilling, which in our country it's a little bit different. From out to 3 miles, the state controls the waters, and we've already passed a law that says we'll never allow oil drilling in those waters. The federal government has 3 miles and beyond, and unfortunately they're still trying to drill in those waters. And not unlike Canada, there was a moratorium that was agreed upon between the states and the federal government, and now in the Bush administration that's being abrogated. The same type of thing is happening here. So that's a problem you're going to have to deal with. I mean, you're not going to turn all the sinners into saints overnight. When you talk about kicking the oil addiction, when you talk about reducing greenhouse gases, it's turning a battleship. And, you know, even if you could turn a battleship that's moving forward so quickly, suddenly inertia would continue to take it a little distance before you could actually bring it back around to where you want it to be. And the fact is, you don't turn a battleship around on a dime. So I think that this is an example of where you're going to have to figure out how to work with those industries, start to dial them back, give them time to adjust. You know, I'm the last person that really wants to see that happen. As I said, if you all elect me president, if you all come down to the United States and elect me president, which you can do, by the way, just go to Chicago. They won't ask for any ID. And in fact, you can vote more than once. Make it worth the trip. You know, there's no question that you know, if people really understood the urgency of this, kidding aside, if I were president, I would put billions and billions into converting all of our engines overnight, buying out the oil companies, doing whatever it took to make this conversion, because it would ultimately be cheaper. But the reality is, governments won't do that, and so we're going to have to work with those industries, get the low-hanging fruit first, which is energy conservation, energy efficiency, the examples I gave from California, and you're using many of them here, then work on more energy efficiency. Appliances, cars, etc., which takes time to get into the fleet, then work on more energy-efficient buildings, which takes time to retrofit or build, you know, and then obviously be changing entire industries. I mean, you do it all a little bit at once, but some of it is just going to take longer to accomplish. Hi. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'm here to suggest a platform for you, and that would be regulation of ports and shipping. Here in Vancouver, the port of Vancouver is a large industrial emitter, probably the second, probably maybe the first soon emitter in our region, and it is expanding because it says if it doesn't, it will lose business to California ports, Washington ports, Portland ports. reports. What I am wondering, with this governor's collaborative, whether you would suggest to our premier and Schwarzenegger and all of these guys that these ports have to get together and aim higher. Right now we have the lowest environmental standard, you know, none here in Vancouver. They do sort of voluntary things right now that we're supposed to be very grateful for, because our federal government will not regulate the ports, as which is the same in the United States.
Right.
We have no one watching these people, and they are using it. You know, the International Maritime Organization is a joke, and no one will move until there's universal consensus. So what I'm saying is, in Vancouver, where they're saying they will not clean up the port until the competitor ports do, and these are Pacific Coast ports, if you guys, the governors, and perhaps the mayors, I think the mayors have to be involved in this, get together and say, we are going to aim high here, because these are large industrial polluters. And anyway, what would you say to aiming something specific, point source polluters?
Well, I would say we're not going to do it until China does.
That's what they're saying, yes.
Oh, wait a minute. China has. We went to the port of Shanghai, which is completely electrified, and they use rail systems to move the containers using barcodes and computers and electric rail systems to move that stuff around the port. They emit, in terms of criteria pollutants and greenhouse gases, one-tenth of the amount of the port of Los Angeles. So we're actually over there learning from Shanghai how to do cold ironing on ships. In other words, when the ship comes in, sits there for 3-4 days, instead of running diesel generators to power the ship, you plug it into the dock. You have, instead of diesel trucks that take the containers and the goods away from the port to distribution centers, you have these rail systems, these electric rail systems and so forth. It's amazing how much can be done when you are willing to do it and you invest in it. So we're learning from China. The Port of Los Angeles now has new leadership under a guy named David Freeman, and believe me, they're taking very aggressive steps to lead the West Coast on this, and I think that will bring the others along. But ironically, this is one of those times we're learning from someone else.
You've got my two votes. I just moved you from I moved you from Ohio, so I'm well aware of voter regularity. The question I had is actually, we have a vehicle right now for change, and it's the cafe rates. But nobody really is pushing that avenue. I mean, I moved here from Ohio. I worked for Honda, and they're the greenest car company, but I left because when I left, I can't really say a lot, but the ratio of car to SUV projects was 80% to 20%, because that's where the market is. That's mm-hmm. where the money's made. The only way that would change is if cafe rates are lowered. And it doesn't seem to be a lot of pressure to pursue that avenue, because this ethanol, in my opinion, it's crap. Because there's a loophole in there that says, well, if a vehicle's ethanol compatible, then only the gasoline, you're well aware of this, right? Only the gasoline portion counts towards mileage.
Well, there's dual fuel vehicles right now, which obviously mostly operate on gasoline because that's what's available.
Right.
But your point about CAFE standards is well taken, and I think you actually are going to see some progress in this Congress, even with this president. I don't believe that you're going to see any serious movement in the United States at the federal level on greenhouse gases, but there is enough appetite now, including by a lot of conservative Republicans, to do something about CAFE. It may not be as aggressive and as fast as many of us would like, but it will be the first serious progress in 20 years. I am fairly hopeful of that, and they'll call that their greenhouse gas initiative for this Congress. So I'd say help is on the way. Everybody understands this. Even the car companies, I think, at this point know they can't resist it. So it's coming. I'm sorry, for those who don't know, there's a thing, a law in the United States called corporate average fuel economy. And it was passed in the wake of the Arab oil embargo in 1973, and it said that, look, we're not going to tell you that car has to get a certain mileage versus this one, but all of the cars you make as a car company must get at least, say, 25 miles a gallon, and then next year it'll be 26 miles a gallon. So you can sell a lot of SUVs, but you got to sell many more fuel-efficient sedans to make up for it, as long as the average comes out that way. Well, we were making tremendous progress in 1975 when it was passed,
average emission, average fuel economy was 18.7 miles per gallon. It got up to as high as 25 miles per gallon, actually 27 miles per gallon. And then it was suspended during the Reagan administration when oil was $10 a barrel and we had a Republican administration that didn't care anymore. If we had continued with that incremental progress year by year, just a little quarter mile per gallon improvement year by year, today we would be importing zero oil from the Middle East. So everybody understands that technology can easily do this. It's a fair way to do it across the company's fleet, and you can make that incremental progress. So CAFE standards are an extremely important point, because even if we are burning ethanol, there's no point in making a lot of it just to waste it. Let's take two more quick questions, and then I'll sign books. And like I said, I'm happy to hang around and answer questions individually.
Hi, thank you for coming. And I just want to say that I find not driving fun and relaxing.
Good.
And yeah, totally. And it's a win-win situation. Everybody here, try walking whenever you can. Tell your friends, your relatives. You get in shape. You save money. You keep the environment clean. It's a win-win-win. We can kick the habit, and it's rewarding.
Thank you very much. That's great.
Question. I'm wondering if there's any discussions within Governor Schwarzenegger's office and maybe even Premier Campbell's office on the issue of carbon taxes. Because while I'm a big fan of all the regulations you're talking about, increasing efficiency standards and slashing subsidies to the wrong things and giving subsidies to the good things, if you really want to get at what somebody was talking about earlier, changing people's behavior on a day-to-day basis across the board, none of this, you know, just because the people in this room think it's a good idea, we're all going to do the right thing, but, you know, so many more people out there aren't yet. The way to do it is you need to start seeing the carbon intensity, that differential in the prices you pay for all the goods you buy and the services you buy. And a well-designed one can be revenue neutral, means we all have more money in our pockets, but the prices that we face are going to be really different, and that changes behavior far more powerfully than pretty much any other behavioral stick that we can bring.
Yeah.
And it can also make our tax system more progressive, depending on how you give that revenue back.
Sure.
So, yeah, where is Schwarzenegger on carbon tax?
Well, I'll be honest with you, we've been talking about it. It was something in our climate action plan, and we're looking at different designs about what would be fair, what would actually do it appropriately. I can't say whether or not Premier Campbell's gotten to that point yet. Obviously, he's just announced getting into this game, and they're looking at all the different policy options, I'm sure. But I actually kind of like what Tony Blair proposed in England. I'm not sure it's practical or going to happen, but he threw it out as an interesting idea, that everyone would be given a carbon allocation, and you'd have a card. And just like you have a credit card, you know how much money is in your account, or a debit card, you know how much money is in your account. When you go buy, say, gasoline, and it takes money out of your account, you'd also put in your carbon card, and it would take carbon credits out of your account. And at the end of the month, if you used more credits than you had had been allocated, you'd have to buy credits. And if you had, so that's the tax. If, on the other hand, you had been very stingy and made sure you weren't buying high carbon intensity products and you had credits left in your account at the end of the month, you could sell those and actually make money. So kind of an interesting way to incentivize behavior. A tax like a sales tax could also be done, and especially with computers these days and information systems, you could easily, that example I gave before about the T-shirt that could prove that it was made very low carbon intensity versus the one very high carbon intensity, this one could have maybe just a 1% additional sales tax, and that one could be a 10% additional sales tax. So there's no reason that we can't use technology to try to figure out a fair way to do this, and it is being studied in a lot of places. Let me thank you very much for being here tonight and leave you with a thought from Shakespeare, who usually finds a way to say these things best. He said, "Nature's bequest gives nothing, but doth lend. And so when nature calls thee to be gone, what acceptable legacy canst thou leave?" I suspect if we walk out of here tonight committed to solving climate change within our generation and kicking the petroleum habit once and for all, that's a legacy of which even William Shakespeare would be proud. Thank you all very much for being here. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your hospitality.
You have been listening to top climate advisor Terry Tamminen answer questions at his book launch in Vancouver, Canada, April 4th, 2007. You can find out more about Terry at his website, terrytamminen.org. That is spelled T-A-M-M-I-N-E-N. And look for his new book, Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction.
Download the original speech free from the Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock, like an electric shock, .org. Look for Climate in our Audio On Demand menu. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening. You can hear Terry Tamminen's speech right here on CFRO Co-op Radio next Tuesday at noon. That's Terry Tamminen on the local Brown Bagger, Tuesday, April 10th at 12 noon. And we have a special Radio EcoShock interview with Terry coming up in our two-hour program on climate scams and solutions, Wednesday, April 18th at 6 p.m. Keep your radio tuned to Co-op Radio, Vancouver's source for news and music you won't hear anywhere else.